The Mark Stein Club Q&A, live around the planet, begins in 30 seconds.
Hey, this is Mark Stein. This week, a Liverpudlian song like no other, plus a cavalcade of English hits. We'll do the cow-cow boogie, get hit, little dogies, that's not English, and Frank Sinatra's musical director takes me through one of his most remarkable recordings. Mark Stein on the town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. And now, here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. September 4th, 2024. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, 9 p.m. in Paris, 10 p.m. in Kiev. 10:30 p.m. in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran in solidarity with the half-hour time zone. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, 7 a.m. in Auckland, and a rather more agreeable hour for the kippers and kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. Oh, never mind the Pacific. What about His Majesty's dominions in the South Atlantic? It is 5 p.m. in South Georgia and the South Sandwich Islands, where they are celebrating Toothfish Day. It's the biggest holiday in both South Georgia and the South Sandwich Islands because it marks the end of the Patagonian tooth fishing season. They celebrate with gingerbread toothfish, if you're wondering how it goes. I'm not sure whether we have listeners in either South Georgia or the South Sandwich Islands. I know that we have them in the Falkland Islands, with whom South Georgia and the South Sandwich Islands were yoked for many years until, I think, late 80s, something like that. I think South Georgia and the South Sandwich Islands are, in that jurisdictional sense, the newest British overseas territory, or crown colony, as chaps like me like to say. There is a developing story out of Georgia, not South Georgia, the other northern Georgia in the Western Hemisphere. As we speak, a 14-year-old schoolboy has been arrested for the shooting deaths of at least four persons at his high school this morning. I may say something about the facts aren't known yet, but I may make a general observation on that a little later. A number to ponder. In 2011, when I published After America about how broke, the United States is, the interest payments on the federal debt were hovering around $1 billion a day. They were just a teensy-weensy bit higher than that on the day Joe Biden took office, if one can call it that. In the last 3.5 years, the interest payments on the federal debt have basically tripled to over $3 billion a day. In most countries, $3 billion a day would be a lot of money, and even more money if it's just the interest on your debt. Let's cut to the chase. There is nothing holding America up. And at some point, that's going to have consequences, and that's not going to be pretty. Okay, that's all I got. Let's get to your query. We don't make a big... We're simplifying the format because people disliked all the non-political stuff, not just the musical stuff, but what some disaffected listener called trivia from the Habsburg Empire. It helps, actually, to know trivia from the Habsburg Empire. To use the example I always quote, since my enforced sojourn due to ill health in Trieste, the Republic of Venice lasted four times as long as the American Republic, and most people couldn't tell you a thing about it. It helps to have a sense of perspective. Lee Phelps says, this is in reaction to the subject suddenly being back in the mainstream news in the United Kingdom, because 12 people, mostly women and children from Eritrea, died in the English Channel, making their way to the United Kingdom. Lee Phelps says, refugees, aren't there a lot of countries between Eritrea and the UK? Perhaps the BBC will post a map for those geographically challenged. What happened to all that UK money given to France to stop all this, says Lee? You're quite right that refugees are meant to stop in the first safe country, which in the case of Eritrea would be many places in East Africa. I mentioned my daughter was there a few months back and had a fine old time. So these people are not, technically speaking, refugees from Eritrea. For the purposes of their legal situation, they're refugees from France. And I can understand that. If you happened to be there when that hideous Olympic opening ceremony was on, you'd certainly want to get the hell out of there. And you might be so desperate after that opening ceremony, you'd even consider the United Kingdom. But this is a sick joke. Now, this whole refugee convention was signed in the early 1950s, and that, in a certain sense, isn't a long time ago, but it is another world, because back in the early 1950s, one continent, Europe, owned almost entirely another continent, Africa. There was Ethiopia, and there was Liberia, and that was about it. But all the countries that we know today from that particular continent, the Congo, Nigeria, Botswana, Chad, Mali, none of them existed. They were all the sovereign property of the European powers, and when this stupid refugee convention was written. So it's a convention from another world. And when you're fleeing, when you're a refugee from Eritrea and you're not willing to stop until you get to the shores of southern England, that's not a refugee. That's something else entirely. Now, the question is, how long? And again, that's just the specific situation, the 12 people who are dead. 12 mothers and children. So it's all very photogenic. It's all very heartbreaking. And it means that the only time this ever gets discussed by mainstream media is in that, we're separating children at the southern border of the United States. Oh, that means we need comprehensive immigration reform, which means that we need to come up with a bipartisan plan to let all these people in a lot quicker. Because there's a lot of people who don't think they're coming in quickly enough. Millions and millions of them are coming in. But a lot of people don't think that's quick enough. It's evil, this. Basically, I don't even blame the human smugglers who charge, whatever these people paid. I think it was £3,000 or something. Because there's a market. The market has been created by evil governments of the post-Western Western world, who, in the interests of utterly transforming their societies, have created a business opportunity for their fellow evildoers. But just looking at it, the evildoers on the human smuggling side, the gangs, are not as evil as the government, who are the governments who are the business partners of the gangs. The so-called Biden administration is the business partner of the Latin American gangs, and the governments of the United Kingdom and Europe are the business partners of the gangs ferrying people across the Mediterranean and across the English Channel. This is evil. These governments are evil. And the fact that it's impossible, if you try to do anything like Trump did with his Muslim ban, then it got struck down by, you know, whatever rinky-dink district court judge it first came up against, and eventually it had to be shrunken to something that would pass muster with these rinky-dink district court judges. And the same applies in the United Kingdom. It has to be crafted so that it passes muster with the European Court of Human Rights. But they're not really, most of the institutions of power and influence in the Western world are not interested in stopping this. There's a whole section of the bar in both the United States, the UK, and elsewhere, a whole bunch of lawyers who make their living from ferrying millions and millions and millions of people into the country. And at some point, people are going to have to get a lot. You know, we had 3 days of anger in the UK over three little girls stabbed to death. Multiculturalism is not a normal state of affairs. This is a freakish moment in history when we are told that all Western nations have to, even as, you know, Saudi Arabia stays utterly unicultural, all Western nations have to become multicultural, the great replacement. And it's the idea that it's a conspiracy theory when it's happening before your eyes every day of the week is absolutely it is terrible. But Lee makes the correct point that if you're a real refugee, a refugee from Afghanistan, you're supposed to go to Pakistan or Iran. Both countries are, for the most part, safe places. But they don't like the sound of that. So if you're an Afghan refugee, you'd much rather go to Sweden or you'd much rather go to America. The indulgence of this, at some point, you know, there's a famous line about the US Constitution, that the Constitution isn't a suicide pact. Well, it's actually looking like a pretty bloody good suicide pact right now. And that is true also for the British Constitution, the Canadian Constitution, the French Constitution, your Constitution here. Keith Farrell writes, oh, he starts by quoting me. That means, of course, I think I wrote this, where did I write it, this morning? That means, of course, that as in America with comprehensive immigration reform, it will be fraudulently framed as a question of bringing them in a safer and more efficient manner. I can see Sir Keir Starmer, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Keith continues, enrolling in the EU student freedom to roam policy. As it applies up to 30 years of age, France can issue student visas, in collusion with Starmer, of course, and they can travel by Eurostar. It won't solve the irregular migration problem, but he will be able to stand up and say, I've stopped the boats. What do you reckon? Nothing seems too far-fetched for these liberals. You're actually right about that. This freedom to roam thing for European Union students. Starmer has already said, basically, Brexit is dead. You know, I'm pretty... I'm more or less... predicted the present state of things when I published The Prisoner of Windsor, that that no matter the vote of the British people and no matter the technical withdrawal from the European Union, there's been no divergence from European Union policy, and Starmer has announced that, in fact, there's going to be even closer tie. There's been no actual separation from the European Union, except in terms of the new UK border down the Irish Sea, in which Northern Ireland is now ruled from Brussels, effectively. There's been no actual benefits to Brexit because no one's tried any, because they've stayed tied to Brussels' apron strings ever since the technical withdrawal. And Starmer's decided Britain's got to get closer still to Europe. So they could do this student thing. Again, students up to 30 years of age. That used to be called middle age back when the Western world was a going concern. But you're now a schoolboy. You're now in 25th grade or whatever it is, as the Americans would say. So if you're a 25th grade student, you can be given a student visa with freedom to roam all over the European Union and in Starmer's United Kingdom. And in case you haven't noticed, all these blokes coming in are young men. So there'd be lots of young men on student visas, no young women on student visas, because it's getting like Afghanistan for the chicks coming in. They don't need these student visas. And yeah, it's true. Occasionally there's a not quite so young man. There'll be some bloke at 37, 38, but he'll be telling people that he's 16 going on 17, because that's how you get all the Euro welfare benefits. I met a lot of them. I've talked about this before. I met a whole big bunch. Well, I was staying with them in their refugee house in southern Germany. They were all these Gambians in their 30s with the first sign of crow's feet round the eyes. But the German state accepted their explanation that they were 16 going on 17. That's the way to get the big welfare. I mean, the fact is people need... Starmer and co. lie. Boris Johnson lied to you. They all lie. Kamala Harris is lying to you. Kamala Harris is promising to fix the border. The person who has let millions of people in over the last 3.5 years, you know, I tell you all the numbers so that it makes Trump's comment about why don't we get more Norwegians when there are only 5 million Norwegians. So if every single Norwegian moved to America, which none of them has any reason to do, it's would be in a drop in the ocean compared to all the third world detritus that has poured over the border in recent years. But Kamala's promising to do something about it. And you know what's going to happen? She'll be answering questions about how she's going to be tough on immigration. She won't be answering questions except in that debate, if she ever shows up for it. But somewhere along the way, she'll put out a statement or she'll give a speech saying she's going to be tough on immigration. And she'll be sounding tough on immigration all the way to her inauguration. Actually, not to her inauguration. She doesn't need to keep up the pretense, does she, once she's been proclaimed the winner? You know, this is the destruct. If you seriously think that voting for the first Montreal schoolgirl to be America's president, that's shattering the glass ceiling, we're not going back. We're not going back to a world where Montreal schoolgirls didn't get to be American president. That's what she says. We're not going back. We're not going back to the days when British subjects like Chester Arthur had to pretend to be born in America in order to become president. We're not going back to that. If you honestly think that that's a reason to vote, you're looking forward to voting for the first Jamaican Indian Quebecois female British subject to be America's president. You're a fool and you deserve to lose your country. And it's very unfair to the millions of people who aren't that stupid, but because of the stupidity, because of the rubbish that is that passes for public discourse now, I can't bear to watch it. As I always say, the biggest story of our time is that the entirety of West... And this goes, when I say I can't bear to watch, it goes for left and right too. I'm not where the so-called conservative talk show... I don't even get how they call themselves conservative when nothing's been conserved. You know, we've now had... We know what happened in 2020. We've now... we're now being told that... by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, that undated ballots have to be counted. Okay? That's great. That's great. And I don't know how long it is. You know, Election Day, I think, is still nominally in November, is it? But I think they'll be accepting undated ballots until however long it takes. You know? The stupidity of all this. Oh, we're not going back. Going back to what? To when America wasn't spending $3 billion a day on interest payments? It's pathetic. As I said, if you go along with this, you deserve to lose your country. It's just unfortunate for the tens of millions of people who don't want to go along with it that they're going to end up at the bottom of the cliff with you and your 401k too. Patrick Gagan writes, the mayor of Aurora, Colorado just confirmed. Yeah, I think he was denying this at one point. This is from a town in Colorado. Where Venezuelan gangs, because as you know, Aurora, Colorado is way down on the southern border, just next to Latin America. The mayor of Aurora, Colorado has just confirmed, again, if you go along with this, the southern border now extends to about 3 miles south of the Canadian border, basically. The mayor of Aurora, Colorado just confirmed that Venezuelan illegal migrant gangsters have indeed taken over several apartment complexes and have pushed out property managers to extort rents from the tenants directly. I can do stories like this all day long, says Patrick. I don't believe the US is getting out of this mess. I've lost all hope that my grandchildren's future is going to be horrible. I think you mean I've lost all hope that my grandchildren's future is not going to be horrible. Your thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, you could do. We could all do stories like this all day long. What's interesting to me is that the so-called mainstream media don't do them. And in fact, even on the right, the only person I know who seriously covers these kind of stories is Howie Carr, the Colossus of New England in talk radio terms. And I guess the way people seem to think, it's not like suddenly having, you know, like when the Germans take Paris. If you're just kind of gobbled up one small town after another, people don't really notice until the towns start getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And one day you're here, Howie Carr's telling you, oh, yeah, Portland, Oregon is now being run by Venezuelan gangsters. These are awful people. You know, you shouldn't. If you live in Colorado, never mind if you live in upstate New York, you really, or Massachusetts, you shouldn't have to factor MS-13 into your considerations. Just think about this. You rent an apartment in Colorado. You're an American. You're an American citizen. You rent an apartment in an American city, and you're paying your rent directly to a Venezuelan gangster. And again, people, because of the class system and the diminution of social mobility in America, people are very heartless about this, particularly liberals. You know, liberals who are in nice little she-she communities that aren't particularly diverse, but, you know, occasionally there may be an Indian software engineer and he seems awfully nice. So they don't really care about I said this, you can look it up on the internet, in that debate with Nigel Farage opposite Louise Arbour and Simon Sharma at the Monk debate. I said at the end in my summing up that we get to fly back to all the nice places. And basically, chaps like Simon Sharma and ladies like Louise Arbour, they don't have to ever set foot among all the places they and the policies they support wreck. Now, Simon Sharma, he's a very smart fellow. And he's noticed that, oddly, since I think around October the 7th last year, something like that, that for some reason his country is now full of people who hate Jews, including a big Jew guy like him. And he's now suddenly a bit, the guy who was mocking me on stage for being paranoid about immigration is now sounding a wee bit paranoid himself. It was all totally predictable. When I said we get to go and fly off back to all the nice places, you know, that's the thing. It takes a while to, you can insulate yourself from some of this stuff, but eventually it will be in your gated community too. Chris Davis says, Mark, I hope you're relatively well. More and more of the quiet stuff is being said out loud in the US amidst the daily word salads that fall from the lips of Kamala Harris. Was this beauty this week? Quote, undocumented immigrants are the least likely to commit a crime, followed by the inevitable cackle of laughter. Now, I know she fell out of the stupid tree and hit every branch on the way down, but this level of mendacious idiocy is simultaneously indefensible yet unreported by the usual suspects in the mainstream media. As she is now within the margin of steel in the battleground states, she's odds on to win this election, isn't she? Very worrying times. The cliff edge is very close indeed. Yeah, undocumented immigrants are the least likely to commit a crime. This is after it has emerged that in New York City, which is a sanctuary city, come on down! New York, the sanctuary city, undocumented immigrants. Actually, what was the phrase the late Senator Harry Reid called them? Undocumented Americans. I actually invented that expression as a joke, and then he stole it from me for real. Undocumented Americans account for 75% of the crime in New York City. Nobody can assimilate people at this level, at the level at which they are being imported to the United States, the United Kingdom, to Canada, to Europe. Nobody could assimilate this number of people. And these fools who are voting for, or who plan to vote for Kamala, are basically voting to ensure that, as was said just 10 minutes ago, that their grandchildren lead hellish lives. Because as I said, on these numbers, America, you know, Europe is going to stagger on as some broken down Islamic Stan, but America is going to be a hellishly violent Latin American favela. There is no need for any of this immigration other than as a way to punish the locals. Now, to go back, I'm trying not to get too into too much of the culture trumps economics kind of thing here. So I'm doing the fiscal conservative thing, because if you just talk about boring economic things, you sound less of a crazy. But the economics are actually as crazy as the cultural loss and the deathbed demographics. When you're spending $3 billion a day just in interest payments on your debt. Now, America is only able to do that because of the Bretton Woods Conference making the US dollar the global reserve currency. Otherwise, if it weren't for that, America would be Zimbabwe. And certainly, no, if you got all the world's powers, invited them to sit round the table in a New Hampshire mountain resort today, they would not make the US dollar the global reserve currency. And in case you haven't noticed, because we've talked about BRICS in the last week, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and now a bunch of other countries have joined in. The rest of the world is making plans for a world after the dollar. What happens when the buck stops permanently? And the longer that America goes, and now who's talking about this? Nobody's talking about this in this stupid system of taking 2 years to decide who's going to be president and then swapping the guy out at the last minute. Nobody's talking about that. People think it's a normal state of affairs that your debt interest triples to $3 billion just in 3 years. Is it going to triple again in the next 3 years? Is it going to be $9 billion a day? All this does is ensure that when everything collapses, it collapses very suddenly. You're not going to get 48 hours notice. You know, you're not going to be able to get enough notice to withdraw whatever you've got in the First National Bank of Dead Moose Junction and drive it up over the border and exchange it for Canadian dollars at the Royal Bank of Canada or whatever, as has happened in Europe in the past. You're not going to get 48 hours notice. So at some point, even the stupid 2-year presidential campaign has to address something serious. You know, I'm a pro-life absolutist on abortion. But I recognize that the majority of people I live among are not like that. You know, everybody's, even people who are pro-life, it becomes a whole lot trickier when the daughter gets knocked up or whatever. And since there has been a constitutional development, the United States Supreme Court struck down Roe versus Wade on the grounds that it's a constitutional nonsense to think that the founding fathers of the United States cannily provided a submerged, disguised right to abortion in the Constitution. All that's rubbish. So now it's one of those things that is decided locally. And in that sense, California is going to have a very different abortion regime from other states and everything. There is hysteria on the left. They're thinking they're pretty confident they can make women's reproductive rights a vote getter for them. And maybe they're right on that. But if you're voting on women's reproductive rights, when you're spending $3 billion a day on interest payments on the debt, You know, as I said, you deserve to lose. You're going to lose your country and you deserve to lose it. Elisa Angel says, Mark should spend today's show pretending to be on his phone so he doesn't have to take our questions. Perhaps Mark could wave to an imaginary crowd, supposedly positioned behind cameramen. Thank that imaginary crowd for its support. Pardon me. Pardon me, I've got a few vocal problems today. I'm just going to take a sip of water if you're listening in Dolby Digital Stereo. I've forgotten where the cough button is. After half a century of doing this, I've forgotten where the cough button is. Why do Kamala Harris... Thank you, the imaginary crowd, for its support, says Elisa, and beat a hasty retreat to avoid questions. Why do Kamala Harris and Tim Walz take these steps to avoid speaking to the press? Is their tactic clever, juvenile, or something else? Isn't the press relatively sympathetic to Harris Walz? If so, why bother with the ruse? Because that's how stupid and mediocre these two wretched candidates are. That even though, as with Dana Bash, whatever it, I can't remember. Does she say Dana and Kamala called her Dana? Whatever. Even with the friendliest interviewers imaginable, who'll ask you these questions, and then they interviewed Kamala for an hour, and then decided that 18 minutes of it were usable. And the 18 minutes were pretty much rubbish, so you got to wonder what the 42 we'll never get to see must have been like. But she, this word salad stuff, you know, you can't talk to her about anything. Doesn't matter whether it's the economy, whether it's the Ukraine war, whether it's migration. She doesn't know anything. She can't be bothered to learn anything. And Walz is kind of the same sort of thing. It's interesting. She has put the numbers back within the margin of steel. Whether she can hold them within the margin of steel for whatever it is now, I think there's still 2 months to go. I notice where the Democrats are going. You know, they're going to New Hampshire. My state? New Hampshire hasn't voted for a Democrat for president since the year 2000, when it voted for Bush. It provided Bush's, its four electoral college votes provided Bush with the margin of victory. And since then, it's a purpling state, but at the presidential level, it, you know, Republicans can still win the governorship and the legislature, but at the federal level, particularly, it's Democrats, Democrats, Democrats. So the fact that she feels the need to shore up her support in New Hampshire, the fact that she chose a Veep from Minnesota, and since then the polls suggest, I don't even believe that. Minnesota is even bluer than the New Hampshire. Minnesota hasn't voted for a Republican as president since 1976, but she's got to go and campaign there because her vice presidential choice has depressed the numbers so much. Again, it doesn't reflect well. Oh, America, they're shattering the glass ceiling. So now every little Montreal schoolgirl at Westmount High who dreams of becoming president will be able to achieve that. This is just moron talk. For a country that's the brokest nation in the history of brokenness. And all that has happened since I first used that line has been that the Chinese and the Russians and the Brazilians and the Indians have started working on how to screw the US dollar and actually make America nothing but a broke basket case. You know, they're planning it. And nobody, I can't stand stand it. I can't stand the rubbish that you get when you're listening to every 55-year-old liberal female's favourite media outlet, National Public Radio. I can't stand the drivel they're talking about, the trivia. But they talk about it in such a earnest and serious way that you assume, oh, it must be serious. And then I can't stand the way the right looks on all this as an opportunity to, oh, they're hypocrites. Yeah? So what? They're interested in power. They're not interested in playing debating society games. You know, if the right is just responding to what the left says and does, there's no point to it. It's like being, it's like being a particularly useless pundit. You have to actually deal with what is going on. And, you know, I talked yesterday or the day before, whenever it was, about this Ukraine war, which has been, someone mentioned in the comments that it's Ukraine is never going to recover from the demographic devastation. You know, they've lost all the young men. Now they're moving on to sacrifice all the late middle-aged men. The people doing this, the clever neocons who've pushed Ukraine into this situation, the Washington geniuses, have taken the great replacement to a whole new level. Because if any Ukrainian woman is planning on getting pregnant as her biological clock winds down, they're going to have to do one thing I liked about Ukraine was it wasn't in the least bit multicultural. The only people I met in Ukraine were Ukrainian. I didn't see the streets. It wasn't like going to London or to Paris or to New York, where everyone under 50 appears to be from somewhere else. It was completely unicultural, except for a very charming lady I found myself sitting at the bar with one night who was from Moldova. So it's a completely unicultural society, but they're going to have to import a lot of, maybe they can have some of these 30-year-old Muslim male students come to you. The Brussels would be happy to facilitate that. And they can seduce the nice Ukrainian blondes with the dark black unibrow. It's a particular look. I quite like it after a while. Stuart Chapman, wait a minute, what's gone wrong here? Isn't this the time that place we usually pause from the passing chariot? Oh, no, we don't do that anymore, do we? Because we moved all the music on this show over to Serenade Radio, Saturdays at 5 p.m. London time, in order to free up more time here to talk about who's up 2 points in Pennsylvania. Because now that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has said that undated ballots, right? Undated ballots. Jimmy Carter wouldn't okay that if he was supervising an election in the Congo. But unfortunately, Jimmy Carter doesn't supervise elections in Pennsylvania. But anyway, people are still interested in who's up 2 points in Pennsylvania, as if these polls are real, and as if whatever the real result should happen to be on election day, that will be permitted to stand. But either way, people seem to think it's important, so our show will ne'er be sullied by my niche Canadian musical obsessions again. Still, if you do fancy a break from who's up 2 points in Pennsylvania, have they said undated ballots from other states and other countries have to be counted too? That'll come next. If you'd like a break from that, don't forget our current tale for our time, The Flying Inn, a highly prescient novel that's 110 years old, but highly prescient, by G.K. Chesterton. It's airing nightly right here at Stein Online at around 7 p.m. North American Eastern. We are live around the planet. It is 17 to 4. if you're in the aforementioned Eastern time zone. And that is 17 to 9 British summer time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Stuart Chapman says, "Dear Mark, a former policeman and leader of His Majesty's Loyal Opposition in Australia, Mr. Peter Dutton was interviewed on Sky News recently and said, I would say to anyone in our community, whether it's in your friendship group, your family group, your work group, if you see their behaviour changing or their thoughts change radically about the government." If their thoughts are changing radically about the government, you need to report that information to ASIO, the Australian Security Intelligence Agency. I can't remember whether they say ASIO or ASIO. The Australian Security Intelligence Agency or the Federal Police as a matter of urgency. As someone who now despises our present governments, both state and federal, are you going to dob me in for my thought crimes? From a twice fellow Markstein cruiser and wearer of T-shirts proclaiming unjabbed, despised, vilified, cast out. No regrets. Stuart from Perth in the 3 a.m. time zone. Yeah, I miss Perth. I always enjoy my appearances in Perth, and it's been a while. I'd like to be back in Perth. Find it very interesting when you look out on the Indian Ocean and you think there's nothing between where you're standing and the east coast of Africa. It's a fantastic place, Perth. But yeah, you're quite right. This is, again, uniparty stuff. When Stuart says the leader of His Majesty's Loyal Opposition, he's talking about a supposedly conservative party. But left and right, and this is why, you know, it's hard to complain, because the right was as much in Australia and the United Kingdom, the right was as much responsible for all the COVID excesses as the left were in France or Canada or wherever. And what's interesting is that, again, that's the sort of, when he says if their thoughts are changing radically about the government, that's the sort of thing that Dame Jacinda Ardern would have said, in fact, has said more or less in slightly rearranged words. It's all about control. It's all about the 24/7 surveillance state. You know, there are things that the Australian Security Intelligence Agency could be doing. There are things that the UK Border Force could be doing. There are things that the Mounties could be doing in Canada. But they have all decided, and the things that the deep state in America could be doing instead, but they've all decided that it's people who whose thoughts have changed radically about the government, that these are the people you have to watch. The American example, which has just happened today, as you know, the Supreme Court said that a lot of these convictions for January the 6th were inappropriate because a law had been applied to them, whatever the stupid law was. I forgot, was it the one about disrupting an official proceeding? That did not apply in the case of these January 6th guys. So the first guy whose re-sentencing came up, so the people who had been given certain sentences then had to go back to court for the judges to take into account the Supreme Court's decision. They basically, what they've done is they say, oh, yeah, this portion of the sentence has to be taken away because of what the Supreme Court said. But instead, we're going to ask you to bulk up the remaining bits of the sentence to their maximum so the guy screwed just the same as he would have been screwed anyway. I've seen this before in action. It happened after the Supreme Court tossed out, using the same thing, really, that a law had been improperly applied to Conrad Black. So Conrad was released from prison And then he's he very sportingly agrees to come back to that Chicago courthouse, and that awful judge sends him back to prison anyway. They basically, this is again why I don't want you waving that constitution at me, because that constitution's enable all this. And to go back to Stuart's point, this idea now that it's basically people who don't just do as they're told that is what the security state is. The security state can't do anything. The big security state can't do anything if someone wants to take a machete to little schoolgirls or someone wants to open fire on his classmates. But the 24/7 panopticon state is very good at getting you, for, as Stuart puts it, having thoughts that about the government that are not the approved thoughts. Leo VT. I met him on a Mark Stein cruise. I always assumed he was Leo from Vermont. But in fact, that is an abbreviation of his surname. Leo VT says, it appears that in the deranged Dominion, the NDP has pulled out of their agreement with Jacinda Trudeau's Liberals. Can we hope for an election this fall? And will it matter? It's possible for a so-called conservative government to get elected, just about. In Canada, it's particularly running the numbers constituency-wise, riding-wise, as they say in the deranged Dominion, is difficult because, you know, you have the Tory heartlands in the West, then you have like NDP sections in British Columbia, then you have the Bloc Québécois in Quebec. So the Liberals are up against fractured opposition forces all across the map from east to west. And when everything works for them, they can often wind up as the only party that wins enough seats nationally to form a government. And, you know, for all the comings and goings of the last half century or so, that basic truth has not altered. And I think back to what I said to Preston Manning's conference in Ottawa many years ago. People were expressing grave disappointment with Stephen Harper's terms in office because he hadn't really, he was an incrementalist. And so he hadn't done anything. You know, you notice when the left are in power, they just go hell for leather from day one. Whether you look at Obama, what he did with Obamacare, Biden with opening the border, these things aren't even popular, but they do them from day one because the bet for Obama was, well, yeah, okay, the pendulum will swing and there'll be some Republicans, but are they going to undo this? And you'll all remember John McCain's thumbs down. And it's the same dynamic in Canada. It's the same dynamic everywhere. The left is in power and the right is in office. And that was certainly true of Stephen Harper's term. And after that, we had, I forget what it was, 3-4 leaders who basically just wanted to play on the left's terms. And Pierre Poilievre has been better than his immediate predecessors. But again, you know, people will recall what I said about him denouncing Christine Anderson, who was on our show for a full hour, that the over-gatekeeping, and I think that's the expression I used initially, Nigel Farage, but it applies here. The over-gatekeeping by leaders on the so-called right basically ensures that things, this is your point about will it matter, Leo, basically ensures that things will be, that you wind up with another Stephen Harper type incrementalist, and not enough. You know, the pace has to be stepped up here. If you're going to have a chance of rolling something back, you can't suddenly decide, you know, it's that if it's one step forward, seven steps back, that actually is going to matter. And that's my concern. That's my concern with all these shenanigans. The other thing, too, is that, you know, the Liberal Party didn't wind up becoming the natural governing party. If you look at the how long Justin Trudeau has been in power, that again, you know, that should never have happened. People, Canadians haven't had it good. The average Canadian is poorer now than he was when Justin became Prime Minister. But people are still people seem to think that, you know, people still have a, again, it's the same thing, totally phony stories, like mass graves, the mass grave story. You know, seize the public's attention in a way that the remorseless underlying realities of sclerosis and death in the West do not. Jay Sparrow says, "Dear Mr. Stein, since you feature music frequently on your broadcast..." Why, we don't feature music on this broadcast. I've told you all about that. We're just all about who's 2 points up in Pennsylvania. "No doubt you have an abiding concern for the state and the fate of the arts. Could modern technology threaten this most human of creations? It's a bit disconcerting to see what generative AI can create in the way of images, text, and music today. Is it possible that many creative jobs will go the way of pre-industrial artisans and craftsmen? There's a wild, ironic twist to all this. Some say that AI will snuff out white-collar jobs first, with skilled tradesmen being the last employed human standing. South Park recently did a great spoof on that premise. For me, there is a dark aspect to generative AI. In some ways, it's really plagiarism on a microchip. The use of previously man-made creations at the speed of electron, maybe even without due credit or compensation to the sad sucker that created it. Well, no one gave a damn about the fate of the blacksmith. Progress marches on with the usual collateral damage." I find AI, you know, vaguely creepy. And the improvements that have just been made in it over the last year, apparently pornographers, well, actually just mom and pop pornographers, I'm not even talking about, you know, whoever it is these days, Penthouse or Hustler or whatever, but mom and pop pornographers are complaining that, you know, whatever, what is it, Pornhub, that... that people are just doing these AI-generated porn encounters, and people prefer the that. And I noticed too, you know, well, we're in this state. Let's put it this way. I think the porn thing is sad, actually, because I think it will lead to even less healthy fertility rates, and I think it'll just lead to people developing such boutique fetishes that they'll be even less equipped to just take a girl for a date at the soda fountain. So it'll make things on that front worse. But the rest of it, we're in this situation in part. If you look at, we now have for the first time in human history, storytelling by corporations, these so-called franchises. And there's been a lot of trouble on that front. Disney has managed to ruin the Star Wars franchise now, because the Star Wars franchise was the imaginative creation of one man, for good or ill, I've never really liked it, but of George Lucas. And now it's a corporation and it's a franchise, and they've managed to wreck that. If you look at pop music, same kind of thing. And so it's not that dip. We've wrecked most of the art. Just to take the poet who will be delivering the inaugural poem on Kamala's big day once she's stolen the election. The poet's crap, the pop singer's crap, corporate storytelling is crap. So it shouldn't be that difficult for AI to produce an X-Men 37 that's as good as the human X-Men 36. It shouldn't be that difficult for the AI to come up with a Taylor Swift song. It shouldn't be that difficult for the AI to come up with an inaugural poem that doesn't need to scan or to rhyme or to make sense. We've destroyed most of the arts. What was the last great symphony that you heard? What was the last great operatic aria? So we've created these basically formulaic, leaden formulae for the arts, that and then we're surprised. Oh, look, this AI is as good as a bunch of sitcom guys sitting around in the writer's room at Paramount. That shouldn't be a surprise given the state of things. What is interesting to me is that this is getting very close to the sensual diversions in Huxley's Brave New World, where the AI will know how to push our buttons. Doesn't matter whether you're talking about the porno or the poetry, the AI will know how to push our buttons. And that will keep us sufficiently diverted that we don't notice that the Latin American favela is rising all around us. But it was in fact, you know, I don't want to use phrases like canary in the coal mine, but in fact the decay in the arts, which has been going on a long time now, was the first real indicator. Before it gets to the $3 billion a day in interest payments on the debt, actually the decline in the arts was one of the first signs that our civilization was totally exhausted. April writes, if you created a required reading list for all citizens of Western nations, what would be on it? Oh, I think it'd be all Slovene novels, which might be a problem for those Western nations that don't speak Slovene. I'm basically, you know, that would be a long list. And what's interesting is that it would include a lot of things that people should actually have been taught when they were at school. I mean, it's very sad, actually, because if your world is not opened up when you're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, it's really difficult to open it up afterwards, because that's the time. If it's very difficult, for example, to acquire a taste for classical music if you didn't do it at school. And likewise, it's very difficult to. What's interesting is that we had a couple of comments to this effect. I think that people said they found sometime on Tales for Our Times some of our novels a bit difficult because of the old language. Well, you know, we're talking about novels that are 100 years old for the most part, or 130 years old. We're not talking about Chaucer's English or whatever. If you're imprisoned in your own historical moment and you can't actually reach back, you're not likely, you're going to be blindsided by whatever's forward, because functioning societies are a compact between the present, the past and the future, and they all relate to each other. And my view of the, my view on when you say, you know, what should be required for all citizens of Western nations, I've always looked at the acquisition of new knowledge as inherently beneficial. I think I must have mentioned this before, but anyway, when I was 20 or 21, something like that, I applied for a job at a radio station in Ontario, and I thought it was for some reason, I don't know how I got this idea, but I thought it was a show about movies that they want. So I figured I know a fair bit about movies. I'm up on that. I can do it. And then when I got there, it turned out it was a classical show. They were looking for someone to present a classical show. And I really wasn't qualified to do that at all. But I took the view, I faked my way through the interview because I figured out in my head, well, you know, who knows how long I'll do this for. I might do it for 6 months, I might do it for 3 years. But at the end of it, I'll know a lot about classical music, which is a thing inherently worth knowing about. So I bluffed my way through it and got the job. And that's why... you know, there's all these silly lines, you know, when people say, oh, you know, you mention Plato and people say, oh, well, that's before my time. And then you mention, you know, Ella Fitzgerald and people go, oh, well, that's before my time. And then you mention Jane Austen. Well, that's before. Well, in case you haven't noticed, most everything is before your time because you're not that particularly important. And there's certainly nothing important about this time. And that's why the whole premise of cancel culture, these people have to be cancelled because they're not like us. Because this guy who was born in 1757 doesn't think like me. The narcissism of that is part of what's destroying us. Midwestern Tim Boggs asks, where is there good news coming from these days? What constitutes good news for Mark Stein? I'm actually in quite a good mood. I mean, I'm in quite a good mood because I've concluded that there's no going back, because going back is the hardest thing to do. So the idea that that people will actually start to take the US Constitution seriously and go back to Jacksonian America, that's not going to happen. And that's as true in different ways in His Majesty's dominions and in Europe too. So what will, if we are to get out of this, what will be coming will be something new. And that poses great difficulties if people like Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab and the people behind AI and the 5 global food hubs on the planet, if they're the ones who get to build what's new. But the evidence is that at least there's a dispute. You know, we're told that in the U.S., for example, conservatives will all die out. All these Republicans will die out because the young people, they're all into the LGBT QWERTY or whatever. What's interesting to me in those German election results is that the AfD is the most popular, the Alternative for Deutschland. They're the so-called extreme right. Well, they may be the extreme right, but they're the most popular political party with voters 18 to 24. What I find interesting just from this little corner of Europe and that little corner of Europe is that there are enough people to actually ensure that there's still a little bit of fight over. There's enough people who are not willing to go into the dark night that the insane governing class of the West is leading us into, actually pushing us into. There's enough people who don't want to go there. And it's never been a numbers game. Not once it moved. You know all this if you're into American history, that most New Yorkers were loyalists. They didn't want to revolt. But the people who revolted meant it more. And they drove all those loyalists to settle on the north shore of Lake Ontario. It's not a numbers game. And often it's the underdogs who are the heroic figures. That's what it's going to come down to. In the end, you're not going to be able to vote. You know, America has corrupt elections. But even in countries that have where they're not driving around mysteriously discovered boxes of ballots in the middle of the night on the Wednesday after the Tuesday night before, even in countries with relatively clean elections, we are moving, particularly because of the whole uniparty thing. So the principal left-wing party and the principal right-wing party both lie to their voters. You know, all these left-wing parties, like hardcore lefties, like Kamala and Tampon Tim, decide when they're going to run for national office that they're going to run as like serious semi-conservatives. They all do that. Keir Starmer just did it. But people are beginning to get alert to the lies. So I find that, you know, I wish there was more happy stuff. But I find that encouraging. I find it, half your neighbours, all this stuff with COVID and masks and monkeypox and all the rest of it. Yeah, half your neighbours are going to do that again. And they're going to give you stares in the grocery shop when you don't wear the mask. But, you know, there's going to be more people not going along with it in 2024 than there were in 2020. There shouldn't be anybody going along with it, but we don't live in that kind of world because the bigger government gets, the smaller citizens get until they just become charges of the state. And you can't... it requires a level of control that makes the disengaged person see this clearly, and more people are seeing it now. You know, you don't get that impression if you read the New York Times or you listen to NPR or whatever, but those outlets have less and less influence. And again, we're forcing the issues now. We're forcing the issues because people like Keir Starmer are jailing persons for a tweet or a Facebook post. And in America, the judges, these rinky-dink politicized judges, are ignoring the Supreme Court and devising ways to send all these people who were unjustly jailed back to prison. Just to go back to this school shooting in Georgia. You know, people say... they go on about, well, we have the Second Amendment, Stein, so we're not like those Euro pussies. We're not going to put up with it. The interesting thing is that since January the 6th, people have put up with it. And it's what is tragic to me is the anger and frustration that expresses itself in shooting up a school or these weirder things like the guy in Las Vegas shooting, you know, whatever it was, 100 and something people at some kind of country music festival. You know, what will be interesting to me is whether on the morning that people wake up and discover that, oh, the dollar's totally collapsed. My 401k is now worth $7 top. What it will be interesting then will be whether these things become more focused. I think they understand that. I think when you look at the people who are running the Western world, when they get into office and they try everything sort of chain. After the Second World War, we change this, we change that, we change the other. We've got a huge shortage of young people. We've got far too many old people. So we brought in all kinds of immigrants to be the children we couldn't be bothered having ourselves. And then it turns out the immigrants, for the most part, are not a net economic benefit to these societies they come into. They're a net drain on those. So what are we going to do about that? Well, OK, we can borrow some money. And they've changed so much. It's like a Rubik's Cube that, you know, every time you click one way and you align, you know, two colors, you align two squares on one side, on the other three sides, it's all gone out of whack. And these people aren't good enough to be able to correct that. So the question then is, what comes after the collapse? And I hope what comes after the collapse isn't just things like this school shooting on a much wider scale, but actually something more focused. And I am, I'm an old school imperialist. As I always say, if I'd had my way, I'd have lived between 1848 and August 1914. But that's not coming back. What's interesting to me is the number of, when you look at these shifts in voting patterns, is that enough people are unhappy with this to want to do something about it. And that is, you know, that does cheer me up. And I try to do my bit. We talk about the past here because we are the beneficiaries of the greatest civilizational inheritance ever. And I do my bit to prevent the woke wankers from destroying every single thing about it. So the author we feature on Tales for Our Time, G.K. Chesterton, he's a guy who would be cancelled by these fellows. They've never heard of him. They wouldn't want to be told about him in school, your university. But these people are important to preserve, as the monks preserved the glories of civilization through the Dark Ages. So in that sense, I'm more chipper than I used to be in a certain sense. As the issues have been forced, I've become slightly more chipper. You want some jolly music? Tough, because we've moved all that to Saturdays, Serenade Radio, 5 p.m. London time. That's 6 p.m. in Western Europe or 12 noon North American Eastern. I do hope you'll join me this weekend. But that's going to do it for today. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links, because Laura Rosen-Cohen rounds up the internet as only she can every Thursday. And don't forget, in just a couple of hours, our nightly Tale for Our Time airing right here. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Stein Club, come on in. The water's fine and we'd love to have you. And don't forget, for the Stein-shy chum in your life, there's a Mark Stein Club gift membership with his or her name on it. Stay safe. Stay free, stay well.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. Rights reserved.